This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
I think it's working.
Okay.
Talk away from it.
Hello, hello, hello.
Talk towards it.
Hello, hello, hello.
Better, and I like that you dropped down a couple octaves. I think that was really good. I think that really affected it. How's Hawaii? You look so tan. Or is it just dark because it's 6 o'clock in the morning where you are?
It's pitch black outside.
It's pitch black. Is it always? Because Hawaii,
like,
is closer
to the
equator,
right? Like,
I
didn't set an alarm because I've been waking up early, and I'm in a room with my whole family, so I was like, I'm not gonna set an alarm. I woke up and it was like 6:02, and I was like, I got this. I jumped out of bed, put on a bra, ran downstairs, peed, grabbed a cup of coffee, set up the Larry's snowball microphone on top of a stack of puzzles, you know? It's been
here we are.
I woke up 15 minutes ago and here I am, and I'm like,
I love that.
Let's do
me,
this.
I researched 15 minutes ago. So, like, we're basically the same. We're basically the same. How's Hawaii?
It's a delight, as always. Bryson,
you think you'll ever move to Hawaii?
No. I mean, like, here's the thing. I'm going to live and die in that house that we are in. Like, I just, like, love Brooklyn. I love the community. I love everything about Brooklyn, frankly. Like, I'm a diehard Brooklynite. And so I come here and I'm so happy here, and I love it because it's special. And I don't think if it was my everyday, I don't think the special would wear off necessarily, but I think it must be really challenging to live somewhere where so much of the population is just passing through. And I also think, like,
so you say that as if we're not also in a big touristy city as well.
Yeah,
but yes, no,
not
I hear
like,
what you're
not
saying.
Not like our neighborhoods aren't. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Like, we can, like, go to Times Square and feel that vibe, as you know I love to do. Yeah. But Brayden the other day was like, you need to start doing that thing again where you take selfies of yourself in Times Square. And I was like, what?
Is that what you, like, I didn't know this. Is this a thing you did?
I had this period of time where on Instagram, anytime I was in Times Square, which, you know, when you're like dealing with normal stuff might be like once every 3 weeks or something that you happen to have to go through Times Square to get to a theater or to go to a doctor's appointment that you're connecting trains, whatever it is. And so I used to do a thing where I'd take a selfie in Times Square where I looked really like, this is so this is magical, which is very funny if you live.
If you live in New York,
that's
you
a very funny thing to do.
You do tend to avoid.
You will
Times
go out
Square
of your way
you
to
here.
Not go to Times Square. So I would take pictures. I think it was a coping mechanism. I would take a picture of myself looking super excited in the crowd in Times Square, and I'd post things like #hashtag the Big Apple, #hashtag never give up, like crazy things like that. And Brayden would like die. He just loved it. So he was like, you have to start doing that again. So I didn't post it on Instagram, but I did start sending him selfies of me in Times Square again.
It's very personalized, a direct mailing campaign that you have with Brayden of your bit in Times Square. I was just in Times Square this Sunday. I went and met some cousins who were in town, which is always fun to see people who are like visiting and be like, how do you like New York? But we went to this brunch spot. Guys, people aren't doing brunch well. People are not well. I went to this place. It was at the top of Empire. I'm going to out them. We were waiting for the elevator for like 10 minutes. I was already late and the elevator was broken, but nobody was out like bringing
telling
people
anyone
around. Yeah. And then it was escape room. They were like, hey, come up to the 11th floor, take stair K. And then you take the back stairs and you go up. But what was very interesting about this is it's right outside of Lincoln Center. And it They have a Gossip Girl, like, special. They have, like, a Gossip Girl experience where you get a cocktail that has XOXO Gossip Girl screen printed on a cocktail. They give people, like, a tea, like an afternoon tea situation. And then they give you a tote, and they give you two cardboard cutouts of the character of Chuck Bass that you can stand in front of, which I want to be so clear. I think these are accusations, but from what I understand about the person who played Chuck Bass, I think he was accused of, like, sexual harassment and, like,
I believe that's
sexual violence.
I've never saw Gossip Girl. Is he the one that then controversial because his famous Ashton Kutcher and his wife, like, went to bat for him? Is that what happened?
That is that 70s show. That is not.
That's a different
Gossip
person
Girl.
Accused.
That is
of,
a different.
Oh gosh, it's so wild that, like, you can just sort of pick any TV show from the 90s
like,
or aughts, and it'll
you have
be like
Glee. You have Gossip Girl. You have that 70s show. You, like, have any sort of situation, there's going to be some sexual harassment. But what is, there were two cardboard cutouts of the one guy that I was like, we couldn't have a Blair Waldorf, Leighton Meester, who is, like, really not problematic at all. Like, we couldn't have Chase Crawford. Like, I don't know, but Chuck, but two cardboard cutouts. I did not do the Gossip Girl experience. And then I had to kill time because my cousins took a horse carriage ride through Central Park.
Mm-hmm.
Good for them. I didn't need to do it. And so I had, like, an hour and a half to kill. I talked to a friend for 45 minutes. And then I was like, you know, how else am I going to kill time in Times Square? What would you do, Quinn, if you had to kill 45 minutes in Times Square?
And try not to spend any money?
Well, I did spend money, but spend the least amount of money.
Spend the least amount of money. I'm in Times Square. Oh boy, this is a hard one. The M&M store?
Close. What I did was I went across the street. I saw a little sign. It was like a beacon. It was like a mirage in a desert. And I went to the Krispy Kreme store, and I waited outside in line, and I probably waited for 20 minutes because I was like, you know what? I'm going to get a hot Krispy Kreme singular glazed donut, which, by the way, it was hot and it was delicious.
Yeah, one of my professors brought Krispy Kremes for us, and he brought, like, a thing of big ones like that and a thing of little ones. And I grabbed a little one. And the reason I grabbed a little one is that I thought I could kind of count how many he brought. And I was like, if I get a little one, then I'm not an asshole if I go back for seconds. And I know Krispy Kreme, I'm going to need a second donut. What I do need to tell you is that when I went back for seconds, I
got
a big one.
When they are, like, I got a little bag and I, like, couldn't touch it because it was piping hot. And then you eat it and it just squishes and
it's
sugary.
Melts in your mouth.
It's so fucking good. And I was like, this is the perfect way in a cold, blustery day to wait for that. And then I saw the show, the closing night of Queen of Versailles.
Oh, it's gotten kind of bad reviews, no?
It was so interesting. I went with two friends who are theater makers,
Kristen Chenoweth
directors.
Still?
Kristen Chenoweth is in it, yes. It's such an interesting story because it's about this woman who basically just wants more, and her goal is to build the biggest home in all of America. And so the theme of
the documentary years ago.
I bet you did. I haven't seen, but it's this woman who, what was so interesting about the piece in and of itself, and we had, like, it was a wonderful conversation after with my friends to be like, what worked, what didn't work, and, you know, trying to solve the problem. A lot of people, I think, were very angry at that show, and I think they were angry because perhaps they thought we were sort of like, celebrating this woman and maybe not offering the critique that perhaps we should have in this conversation of this woman, because part of the tension of it is that she's building this house in 2007 because her husband works in timeshares and takes out loans and stuff from the bank. And of course, in 2008, the crash happens, the housing market crashes. And what's fascinating is that the government ends up bailing this family out versus the thousands, the millions of people. I mean, the hundreds, I don't know how many people, but the many people who were affected. Mm-hmm. And I think it could have been, my biggest critique was I was like, it felt like it took all the teeth out and it didn't have, it had flashbacks to the French Revolution, but it didn't totally, you know, this idea of like, she wanted to make her own Versailles. She wanted to model this home off of Versailles, which is an interesting parallel of like the French Revolution and what's, you know, the have and have nots, and also the rich upper class who are spending money and just living in excess, where people who can't afford to make ends meet and the people that work in the house and things like that. There's a lot of interesting conversation, but none of it really, like, to me, hit home. And the observation that I was shared with my friend who was there was like, the people that supported the show, the investors of the show, are the people with millions of dollars that can lose millions of dollars in a weekend on Broadway. And so could they make the critique of that class when that class is funding this project? I don't know.
Interesting. Interesting.
Really interesting stuff. I got to watch the documentary. I should have watched it and shared the story with you. But
that's I'm just angry when I think about certain rich people and the way that they are ruining our world. And then Whitney told a story at dinner that had me heartbroken about someone in her dang neighborhood that was getting all new things, like redoing their home. And they took all these clothes, all these giant pieces of furniture, just tons of stuff, and filled a dumpster. No charities, no Facebook marketplace, just like landfill. I was like, Winnie said she cried. And I was like, I would too. That's really intense.
We're on the holiday season and I have to go do the thing tomorrow. I'm flying to Chicago tonight for the holidays. And then tomorrow I have to like really get into it and go shopping. I have to go pick up gifts for people. And part of it feels so bad because I'm like, nobody needs anything.
Yeah. Support you know, local, like, support local businesses, you know, do what you can. There's always like a little way you can make it less. Watch Shark Tank. See who went out there. See what they got going. You know,
I'm going to get everybody's scrub daddies. You get a scrub daddy. No, but then we're like helping Mr. Fucking Fabulous, Wonderful. What the fuck is that guy's name? Okay. Hello, sharks. Thank you so much.
I told you we could do my vacuum idea. My carpet that comes with vacuum marks in it. So it always looks like you just vacuum before people come over.
I didn't know this idea. I don't think you've shared this idea with me, Quinn.
Oh.
This is $1 million deal.
I mean.
Tell us.
It's just
a carpet with a vacuum marks in it.
Yeah, so it looks like you just vacuumed. So whenever people come over, they're like, oh my God, that's so nice. They vacuumed for us. Like they knew we were coming. They just vacuumed. You don't think it's a great idea?
I think what's funny about it is there's like, in knowing me, it'll have crumbs on it. It'll be like a vacuum marks with crumbs on it.
Even so, I think they'll think you just vacuumed and then accidentally dropped something. It's like the vibe to guests who are coming over to your home is Carrie knew I was coming and she just vacuumed.
Look at her.
I feel good about that.
Honestly, I'm looking for any rug. I have no rugs in my apartment. I think I should probably get some rugs.
Oh, you want to go through the basement? I think we have a couple just that didn't, you know, that we have had for, there's nothing wrong with our rugs. Don't give me that face. These are good rugs.
I didn't
give
you a face. I go, it's just funny that you're like, you should come to our basements. We've got a couple rugs.
Go rug shopping.
That is a funny premise.
Oh yeah.
That is funny to me.
And then I kill you. And it was the long,
put me in
it was
the rug,
the long
and
con.
Then put me in a rug.
And then now like, you can look have, at this rug me, forever.
And then put me in a dumpster and it looks like legitimate good rugs. And then Whitney comes by and she's just, you see her crying. I don't know. I think we found the story. I think all I'm saying
like,
is we just
don't
found a
waste.
Great.
Be like Matt. Put a tablespoon of jam back in the fridge. Put a teaspoon of yogurt back in there. Be like Matt. Save the world. Turn off all the lights.
By the way, you're listening to Truly
Darkly
Creepily.
I'm Quinlan Posner.
I'm Carrie Epema. And
who goes first?
I think it's an even, so I think it might be mine.
Cool.
I do want to say we do have, I just want to give a shout out to Sylvia. Sylvia, 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 woof, woof. You are so freaking great. Sylvia edited their membership, raised it a couple bucks, and I gotta say, Sylvia,
that ain't nothing, thank Sylvia.
You. And nothing. I think we've sang to you before, but I don't care. I'll sing you another song. Sylvia, Sylvia, you are such cool person in the world, and we love that about you.
We love you.
Thank you, Sylvia. What a fun treat to open up our email. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
I got my information from an episode of 48 Hours. I'll be honest with you. I was looking up. Here's what happened. We're putting this episode out the week of Christmas, and I was looking for Christmas stories, and I was like, oh, what Christmas true crime? And honestly, they all depressed the fuck out of me. They all were too much. I was like, it just was too much. So I'm doing another murder. But it's not around the holiday. It takes place around January 1st.
Great.
New Year's murder. I'm going to bring you to San Diego, California. It's January 1st, 2021. 911 gets a call. This guy is on the phone, is talking to the 911 operator, and is saying, hey, listen, I got to tell you something. I was sitting on the fence of telling you this, but here's the deal. Last night, a friend of mine asked me to come over, and I asked her why. And she said that she possibly killed her stepdad. He was like, I'm not coming over. So he now has a knowledge that, like, maybe her stepdad is dead. We don't know what's going on. She says that she drugged him, suffocated him, and strangled him to death. So she calls this guy asking to help move the body, seemingly. And he said, no, thank you. I'm all set. Pass. Happy New Year.
Yeah.
You know what? It was my New Year's resolution to not help aid and abet a murder.
Yes.
New Year's resolution.
You know what? That's mine too this year. I feel like I can really stick with that one.
I feel like that's a good resolution. I feel powerful in that. So he's saying to the 911 operator, I stewed on this all night. I didn't see a body, but I feel like I have to call. 911 gets this information. They contact the local police authorities. Because of this call, they get a search warrant. Mm-hmm. And the police go over and they do a wellness check at this house. And so they drive up to the house, and on the driveway, there's like a pile of trash. And so as they're entering the premises or the house, they see this woman, neighbor, get in her car and leave from next door. And they're able to see this woman. Her name is Jade Jenks. Mm-hmm. And she is the woman in question. That this person in this phone call is accusing. She is the man, Tom Merriman's stepdaughter. So the man who is possibly dead is Tom Merriman, and his stepdaughter is Jade Jenks. So she's pulling out of her driveway, and the police are like, wait. We did want to talk to you real quick. And so they bring her into the police station. She's like, I feel so cold. And so they give her a blanket. And so there's like footage of her in a blanket. And they're like, have you seen your stepdad? And she's like, I saw him yesterday when I picked him up from the hospital. And they're like, really, you know, we got this call that he's missing. And we don't know. They don't reveal what the call said, but they're like, we got this call that he's missing. Have you seen him? And she's like, you know, I picked him up yesterday. He was in the hospital. He took a spill. I don't know. I haven't seen him since. I don't know what's going on. I don't know what's happening. And they're like, okay, kind of suspicious. Mm-hmm. So they're looking in the house and they don't find him anywhere. Like, we can't find Tom Merriman. We don't know what's going on. They ask neighbors about it. So here's a little bit about Tom that you should know, is that Tom is like a really nice guy. In fact, the business that he runs is a butterfly farm. And he married Jade's mom. Pretty cool. He married Jade's mom when she was 14 years old. They had a really nice relationship. She calls him dad. He treats her like a daughter. In fact, they live next door to each other. And she cooks him meals. She would pick him up from the hospital. She's his daughter, and all, for all intents and purposes. They have a very close relationship. And a little bit about Jade is she's like very cool. People talk about her like she's pretty popular. In the 48 Hours episode, they kept showing pictures of her just like looking really hot and fun and nice, or like just like a good time gal. And so you're like, what is going on here? What's the story? So what you should know is this garbage on the front lawn, she had gone over to her neighbors earlier on January 1st, Jade, and she was like, hey, I made a mess in front of Tom's house. Just so you know, I'll clean it up. Like, don't worry about it. Once the police are like trying to find Tom and they can't find him in the house or anywhere, a police officer is like walking and she sees this pile of trash. And I think it's a woman, I don't know, but it's the police officer sees this pile of trash and moves one of the bags. Now, just to be clear, this pile of trash, there's like a wheelbarrow, there's like boxes, and there's like sacks of trash. And so this police officer moves one of the garbage bags, and it's there that you can see underneath this pile of garbage, there is a silhouette of a body wrapped in a blanket.
Okay.
It is Tom's body. Tom is on the driveway. Jade had previously been like, I made a mess. I'll clean this up. Don't touch it. Mm-hmm. Tom is wearing the shirt he wore when he was released from the hospital the previous day. He's wearing his hospital bracelet. And at this point, based on the phone call, based on this information, based on all, we've got a suspect. We mm-hmm. know Jade Jinks is involved in this. However, once they start interrogating Jade, mm-hmm. she immediately lawyers up and she stops cooperating with the police. Mm-hmm. So at this point, they need to prove cause of death because all they have is this 911 phone call accusing her, which again, there's like not, this person didn't see a body, so we don't know what exactly happened. So the body goes to the coroner and the autopsy comes out and the cause of death is acute Ambien intoxication. And what's interesting about this is that Tom has a prescription from Ambien and was released from the hospital the previous day. So it could have been an accidental overdose. What's also interesting is that there is no evidence of strangulation on his body. So like the whole like, I strangled him, I drugged him, I strangled him. Like she could have drugged him, certainly, but there's no evidence that he was strangled and that was the cause of death. So this also takes kind of the wind out of the sails of the investigators as well because they're not sure how to actually move forward and mm-hmm. fully accuse her of this crime when the cause of death could be an accidental overdose.
Okay.
But then they're able to look through Jade's phone and her texts detail a different story. Here's what you need to know. December 23rd, about a week prior, Tom had a pretty bad fall. And so he had to go to the hospital to get fixed up. Now Jade is over at his house and she's cleaning up his area, his living room, and he has a computer. And this is Jade's recounting of this. But what happens is Jade moves the mouse on the computer and up pops a screensaver. She recalls looking at the screensaver and seeing a woman's breast. She then realizes that it is her breast. And she's absolutely gobsmacked. On the screensaver, there is a nude photo of her in the shower that she took and shared with her boyfriend at the time. She never shared it. According to her, she never shared these with Tom. It is then that she knows his password, and what she finds is even more shocking. There's not just one photo of her nude. There are hundreds of nude photos of her on his computer. This is her stepfather, who she's known since she was 14 years old. Oh, my God,
that makes me so sick for her.
She talks about feeling, she texted a friend, I am beyond freaked out. She does not know how Tom got these photos at all. She talks to her friend about not being able to go into a shower, about being freaked out, about being naked, feeling totally exposed and totally beyond hurt.
Yeah.
She starts sleeping with a knife on her nightstand in case he comes home early from the hospital. So at this point, her friend connects her to this guy who they refer to as the fixer. His name is Alan Roach, and he's a security guard. And the prosecutors who are investigating this case and trying this case ultimately kind of start laughing about Alan Roach because they're like, we think he thought he was like the guy from Pulp Fiction, you know, the like big kind of guy who fixes things, but he's not. Like he's not a hitman.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we need to know what's most important about this is who Jade believes this man to be. She believes this man is going to help her.
Mm-hmm.
And they believe, based on these text messages, that she plans for Tom's murder. We have these text messages between her and Alan. We have all this information about what was going on and what she found and sort of the state of mind that she's in. So the trial starts December of 2022, which is about two years after he was found dead. Her defense maintains that from the beginning that this is not a murder, that she has never admitted to the murder, that she declares her, she maintains her innocence. They say that his death was an unfortunate accident where he took the drugs that caused his own death. At the trial, her family, she has friends there to support her.
Mm-hmm.
The prosecutors in this case are very worried because of the information about the photos that they found on his computer, which I want to be clear, after his death, they did not preserve his hard drive. So we don't know factually. We don't have a ton of proof that these pictures existed. However, even the prosecutors in this case are like, we did see the screensaver and we believe there were more photos. We don't know the context of them, but we do believe these photos existed on her stepdad's computer. But they were worried that at the trial, the jury would see her as the victim and that could affect their case because it's a muddy case because mm-hmm. you don't necessarily need motive to try someone for murder. It does help. And her motive is, I mean, it's fucking dark. This is a man who raised her since she was 14 years old. Jade takes the stand at her own murder trial, which you don't have to do, as we all know. But she takes the stand and she recounts her relationship with Tom was that of parent and child. So mm-hmm. that when she found the photos, how distressed she was. She had no idea how he received those photos. And she claims that when she picked him up on December 31st, that he had a big bag of pills, including his Ambien, and Tom even saw her pills, and he helped himself to them because she had some pills in the car.
Mm-hmm.
While she was on her way home, she stopped at this place, I think called Dixieland, and she buys gloves, towels, a nylon cord, and some spray paint, to which she says this is for a home painting project.
Okay.
The prosecutors will say, well, painting project, murder kit, tomato, patata, I don't know. So
tomato, paternal.
Tomato, murder. So at this point, Tom is not, has taken so much pain medication that he's not able to walk on his own. So she tries to go back to the rehab where she picked him up from and asks them for help. They refuse to help her or let her inside because of COVID. Now, keep in mind, this is her telling of it on the stand.
Mm-hmm.
She then contacts Alan Roach, the quote fixer, and she asks him to meet her at Tom's house so that he can help get Tom inside because he's incapacitated because of the drugs. Alan is like, I can't come, but I'll send my friend Brian. Brian comes and he's like, I'm not going to help Tom get inside. And then Jade's like, oh, who am I going to call? And then she calls Adam Siplak, and Adam gets upset because he sees the state of Tom and he leaves without helping her. Now, keep in mind, Adam Siplak, person who initially made the 911 call,
mm-hmm.
who's saying that she said that she drugged him and strangled him and suffocated him. Jade is saying that she can't get Tom out of the car, so she sets him up with pillows to sleep in her car overnight because she can't move him. And it is the next day that she finds his body and she finds him dead in the car.
Mm-hmm.
And she is distressed. She knows his body. She feels his body is cold. She's distressed. She's trying to get him out of the car and into his house, and she can't lift his body weight. So what she does, instead of calling 911 because she doesn't want to get blamed, she tries to get him out. So she can't get him out of the car, like I said, so she goes to the hospital to get a wheelchair. Now, while she's at the hospital, it's pretty damning. She has a dead stepdad in her car. She just asks for a wheelchair. She grabs a wheelchair, doesn't ask the hospital to help this person who's in her car. She goes back to the house, gets him out in the wheelchair, puts him on the driveway, sees that she can't get him any further, covers him with trash and boxes, and stages it with a wheelbarrow and calls it a day and moves on and hopes that to not get found out. She claims she never wanted him dead, that she was just like, it does look bad, but that's not what happened, right? That's kind of her story. The prosecutors tell a different story. They say that she is lying to cover up this plan, that she knocked him out with his own pills. What's interesting about the Ambien case, or the Ambien pills, is that it has her DNA on it, not Tom's. It's like she's trying to cover it up. Her cell phone is also packed with texts outlining her plan. She sends text after text to Alan being like, I just dosed the hell out of him. And they're hey, really what bad. Do you think that means, Jade? And she was like, I guess it's poor phrasing. This is her excuse. And then she writes stopping at Dixieland to stall. She's like texting a play-by-play of the actions for that day. She writes, he's waking up. Can you come over? She texts when Alan says, no, he can't come over. And she gets Brian's information. She texts, I want you to bring him inside, strangle him, and I'll take care of the rest. Brian says, I'm not interested in that. Thank you so much. Keep in touch. Have a great new year. She then texts Alan. He's waking up. He's getting more aggressive. At 4 o'clock on the 31st, she texts, fuck, he's up. I guess I'm on my own. And Alan does not text back. Prosecutors believe she puts a bag over his head. And there is a bag found in her car, and it has her DNA on the outside and Tom's DNA on the inside. But again, what's interesting is there's no evidence of strangulation on the body. At this point, the prosecutors are relying on information that you can strangle someone when they are knocked out or unconscious, and it might not show that they were strangled because their breathing is so belabored and slow. And they say it takes 4 pounds of pressure to kill someone, to strangle someone. Just as in terms of comparison, a handshake is about 11 pounds of pressure. So the actual, to actually strangle someone, it doesn't take a ton of energy to do so. And if this person was already unwell on a ton of medication, there might not be evidence that he was in fact strangled. What we also know is that moment where the police show up and we see her leaving her house next door, she texts Alan one final time, lose my number. It's not looking good, Jade. It's really not looking good. So the case rests. The jury goes out that afternoon to deliberate. They come back the next morning. By 9:30 a.m., they have a verdict.
Mm-hmm.
She is found guilty of first-degree murder.
Wow.
At sentencing, Tom's friends speak in support of him. Jade's biological father speaks in support of her. And Jade speaks and talks about what she believes is that Tom groomed her, and that relationship was manipulation to this just terrifying, distressing end of his life and this distressing moment of hers. She is found guilty and she is sentenced to 25 years to life in prison for the murder of Tom Merriman. What's really heartbreaking is that these images were not able to prove any of this. Like her accusations at her sentencing were not able to prove this manipulation, what this is. Again, we don't have the hard drive of those images, but the prosecutors do believe those images did exist.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just an absolutely heartbreaking story.
But I mean, you feel for her, you do. It, like the anger and the shock and the betrayal and not feeling like she can carry on. And I get all of it. It's just, there's a lot of people she could ask for help. And I don't mean help with the body.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Also, like, it just seems so, like, the amount of people she asked and was texting all of this. Like, all of it feels like, and also to come up with this plan from the week after she found these images and didn't, you know.
Like, let that marinate a minute. Take a pause.
Aye.
I got a story for you.
Tell me.
All right. I watched an episode called At the Bottom of the Lake. It was a Dateline 2020.
Right.
And man, Keith Morrison, Lester Holt, couldn't love them more. Keith comes in hot at the very beginning. He's like, love, intoxicating, impetuous, foolish, love that lives like a fugitive in a long secret tunnel of regret. And you're like, I'm in, Keith. What's gonna happen? The story is in Northwest Montana. There's a glacial lake in a national park. It's called Bitterroot Lake. And the vibe I'm getting on Dateline is that all these families come to summer there and have homes. And it's got like a generations have come here. The homes are getting passed down and everyone's coming together to have lake life. And mm-hmm. this woman who is a witness to something bizarre is talking about how she and her mother were living their lake life. And she has a couple brothers and they're walking around the forest and her mom are on some kind of errand. And they drive up to their cabin and they see a stranger on their deck and they go to confront him. And the mom is like, "You're trespassing." And the guy kind of has an empty look about him, but he doesn't look scary. Like she remembers he was wearing a white crisp shirt and it didn't have like a, this guy's like, you know, a vagrant, he's trying to break in. It was like a truly maybe somebody that was lost or something. And they have a conversation with him, but he's being very vague where they're like, "Where did you come from?" And he's like, "Over the mountains." You know, it's like, okay. He ends up just leaving and they talk to the brothers later who come back from their walk and they're like, "Well, we saw somebody in the forest, a stranger too. And if we timeline this, it seems like we saw him before you guys saw the guy on the deck. I wonder if it was the same guy." And so they're describing to each other the stranger. And it's weird because some of the things line up, maybe like height and build and hair, but the mom and the sister are like, "He was dressed like this." And the brothers are like, "No, he was soaking wet. He was soaking wet and he was definitely not in a clean, crisp white shirt. And he asked us for matches. We went to the store and bought him some matches and came back and gave it to him. And when we gave it to him, we made a fire and he started burning things. It was pretty weird." So rumors are now floating around the town, and you take the rumors of having seen this stranger. And another thing folks have noticed that they've been calling the sheriff about is that the lake seems off to them. It seems oily. And a guy that is a pilot is like, "This is not boat gasoline. It's not what it looks like to me. It looks like airplane gasoline." And could it have been that we've all seen the Ozarks. Is there some sort of like drug smuggling, something going on where somebody landed a plane in this water? Planes can be really quiet. Nobody knew. They dropped some oil. Maybe a plane crashed and it's inside our lake. So all these rumors are getting annoying and they have to do something about it. So Deputy Jim DuPont, who is also a private pilot, so he has a lot of knowledge about airplanes, he's on the job. He walks the lake and he sees the fire pit that they have been made reference to, and he's looking in the fire pit to try to determine what was burned. And he sees something called a gust lock, which is something that is a piece of a plane. And he sees a mic jack that's for a plane microphone. And he's like, "These things have to do with airplanes. I know because I know planes. I'm going to grab the gust lock and I'm going to go try to figure out what kind of plane it would have fit in." He figures out that it's a Cessna 150. And so they're like, "Yeah, this feels off that there's a pieces of plane that a stranger was burning by the side of a lake. We have to figure this out. So let's call some divers." And they call these divers who have this impossible job because it's the 80s. So there's not as good of technology to figure out if there's something in the depths of the lake. And the lake gets up to 200 feet and it's an enormous lake. So it's not like you can just dive around and like maybe find something. So they're on a boat trying to use sonar to see what they can find. And eventually they do get a hit and they lower a camera down and they're like, "It's a plane." So it's at the bottom at like 200 feet. So they use cables. So they pull it up to 100 feet and the divers check it out. And they're like, "Sure enough, yeah, it's an airplane. And there's a woman's body in it. Not even decomposed. They said it was like ghostly. She's floating in the plane. She looks like she's sleeping." They start to backtrack to try to figure out where did the plane come from. And they end up that a month before they fish this plane out of the water, there's some unusual activity at an airport in Penticum, and they notice a rescue plane has gone looking for something, and they're like, what are you looking for? This is a month prior. And the rescue plane is, we're looking for an aircraft that was flown to this town. Two teenagers were on board. They landed here in Penticum. They refueled, and they seemed like they were a couple. They got out of the plane while it was refueling. They organized a bunch of their items, and then they left, and they went into a no-fly zone, and we never saw that plane again. Okay, so who was on board? They're looking at the past, trying to piece this puzzle together. So they're like, who was on board that plane? And they're like, a guy named Jerry Abrozek. He has like a different name, like Yanni or something, but he goes by Jerry. He's from Poland. He was a Boy Scout that wanted to be a pilot, and his 18-year-old girlfriend, Diane Babcock, who was a runner that wants to be a nurse. And they were going together in high school, boyfriend, girlfriend. They vanished. Everybody was like, they're Romeo and Juliet, and they ran away together, and it's so romantic. And their parents are like, that's not what happened. We were not against the relationship. They weren't like running from anything. So then they start trying to probe who is Jerry, because that means this woman floating in the plane could be Diane. And they get in touch with this kid, Tom Pulowski, who was Jerry's friend. And he's like, yeah, Jerry actually called me after the plane crashed. He told me that they crashed it on purpose and that Diane was still in it, and that Jerry was in shock and he ran. And he called me from a bus terminal in New York City, and he just seemed in shock. And they're like, can we tap your phone? Because it feels like you're the only person that he trusts. He might call you again. And he's like, sure. So they tap his phone. And then Jerry calls him again from Dallas, Texas. And he's like, why did you guys run away? Why did you take this plane to begin with? What was the story there? And Jerry was like, well, I was going because I wanted to go, and she was going because she was in love with me. And the way he talks about it, he's like, she was in love with me or some shit. Like, he's very
flippant about it.
He's flippant about it for somebody that lost someone they love. And he's also a teenager. So it's, I don't know. It's strange. I can't get a total read on it listening to the call, but he's like, she went because she was in love with me or some shit. And so she tagged along, and it was a vibe of, I didn't necessarily want her there. This was not us against the world. It was like me against the world. And she said she couldn't live without me. He sounds almost annoyed. It's hard to say. But then later in the call, he's like, losing her was like losing half of myself. So the really mixed signals, which is fine. I don't know if he's like defensive. I don't know what he's feeling. But he said he called in the crash. He wanted to make sure that Diane was found, but he felt like he can't come home and turn himself in because they'll call it murder, because he did a thing and now this woman is dead. And so he's on the run. And so it's also a feeling of like, if you didn't do anything wrong, why are you on the run? I don't know. It's so strange. He says that when they crash landed the plane, which was deliberate, he took out a life raft and survival gear, and that he was able to get to shore and she wasn't. And he doesn't go into a ton of detail on the phone, but he is very clear that, like, he wasn't trying to kill Diane. They were in it together to crash this plane, and then she didn't make it. And so now they're looking at the crash scene now that they have this information, and they're like, okay, well, she doesn't have any weird wounds. It doesn't look like he, like, hit her on the head or strangled her or anything weird. It looks like she drowned. Also, her lap belt was on, and it was flipped. It was turned so that the buckle was facing her body. So you can imagine if you were in a panic and you reached down to undo the lap belt and you didn't feel the buckle correctly, you'd be like, what the fuck is going on?
Right.
And you don't know what state of mind somebody's in it. They just went through a plane crash. The other thing they think is weird is that none of her nails are broken and there's no bruising at all on her hands. And so there's this other feeling of, if you're drowning, if the plane is going under and you're drowning, how hard are you fighting?
You should be fighting. Yeah.
They also find out that just days before the crash, she had gone to a clinic and had an abortion. So they're building this story where they're just like, we don't know if that's important. We don't know what's going on. One thing that they feel weird about is that they're like, okay, we know that he had time to get the raft. We know he had time to get the escape bag that had some things in it, had his white crispy shirt and a few other things. Why didn't he have time to help her? Like, why didn't he have time to unbuckle her belt and get her out if she was going to drown? Mm-hmm. Why didn't he have time to get her and help her? It's just sitting so weirdly with them. They know where he called them from in Texas, that it was this phone booth. But what are they going to do? Go post a guy at the phone booth and wait and hope he comes back? And that's like kind of crazy thing to do. They just can't figure out what to do. So years are passing. Years and years are passing. And, oh, this was so sad. And then Diane's parents, who you can imagine are so devastated, they go always to the cemetery to visit her grave. And they're driving there one time. And a bus smashes into their car and kills her mother.
Oh, my God.
Driving to the cemetery to visit their dead daughter.
Oh, God.
I was like, their parent, they didn't get interviewed by Dateline, but I was like, I mean, the dad didn't. But you're like, oh, my. Wow. Like, what a life, sir. So she's killed at 65. And now 25 years have gone by and they haven't found Jerry. And then the story shifts to this woman, Gina, who lives and works in Dallas and is online dating. So you know where that's going to go. But it was interesting because they're like, what's your job? And she's like, I work at a lab. And when they create a new technology, they send it to me to try to figure out what are the small things that seem off and then look closer. I'm a technician in failure analysis. And so that's like an interesting piece of how her brain works is like, is something not lining up? If so, dig deeper. So she meets a man named Michael Smith on a dating site. And his profile says something like, I'm honest and I don't cheat or play games. And she's like, heck yeah. I love an honest guy. That's my main thing. That's my deal.
That's my whole deal. I want a guy who's honest.
My whole deal is honesty. The whole program. So they go to dinner and she sees his class ring at dinner and she knows that he has a bachelor's degree in aerospace engineering from his profile. But his college class, she says he's the same age as her, but then his college class ring and the year aren't lining up with that, where she's like, you would have been finishing college while I was finishing high school. So are you really, really smart? And he's like,
And are you really honest? Are you really being honest?
And he's like, mm-hmm. They keep dating for a long time. Long enough, I mean, that she continues to interrogate this point and doesn't drop it. And they are dating long enough that she knows he had a true love that died, that it really impacted him, and he has trauma from that. But she just keeps pushing about the age thing, and finally he's like, you're right, I lied about my age. I said I was 34 and I'm 43 and I lied. And she's like, what the fuck, dude, your profile, don't lead with I'm really honest and like have this crazy lie. So she's, it's funny because when she's talking to Keith about it, she's like, you can tell. She's like, can you believe it? And Keith's like, I can't. So then what happened? And she's like, well, if you're lying about your age, what else are you lying to me about? And I was pushing. And eventually Michael Smith isn't my real name. My real name is Jerry Ambrosic. And she's like, bro, your profiles, like you're honest. You're lying about your age. You're lying about your name.
Your name.
But then Keith's like, so what'd you do? And she's like, well, I didn't break up with him.
It's slim pickings out there. Sometimes, you know what? A red flag can fucking pop up and you just can be blissfully ignorant. We've all been there, girlfriend.
I felt bad for Gina because Keith was clearly so disappointed in her. He was like, you didn't. Like, he was like, no, you didn't.
Really?
It's like, oh, yeah, no. Keith was like, Gina, what the fuck?
Hey, can I say, Keith, welcome to what's being a girl. You know what I mean? Like, how many times we've been with a friend and it's like, you're still seeing it? Okay. okay.
He was okay. Coming in hot with some judgy eyes. And I was like, oh boy, Gina, this is a hard interview. This, I'd be sweating. You don't want to disappoint Keith. So she Googles him, though, now that she has his name, and she reads about the crash, and she understands now that he is, wanted. Right now, the longest-running fugitive from America's Most Wanted, and he's wanted for negligent homicide. And she's like, I don't know. This is pretty dicey. And he's like, do you want to go to Japan with me? And she's like, I don't even know if you'll kill me. I don't know if that's your bag, but sure, I'll go. So they go to Kyoto, and she's talking about how it was like they found out they weren't in love on the trip, where she would want to take a lot of pictures of everything. He was just annoyed. It doesn't sound like they got along that well. It wasn't like big blowouts. It was just like truly obvious when they were on their way home that the relationship was going to be over. But on the way home, I do want to note that he had, I don't know, enough money or upgrades that he had one coach seat and one first class seat. And he gave her, knowing they were going to break up, the first class seat.
To be honest, I don't think I'd want to be next to him on a plane knowing his history anyway. So I feel like
still, we've all won can the you day believe that he was like, here's the first class? If I knew I was breaking up with somebody.
And they knew my deepest, darkest
bye,
secret.
Bye, you're in coach. Yeah, no, maybe he gave her the first class because they knew. You're right. That was like his parting.
He knew
please
that she knew
tell.
Who he was. And he's like, oh, God, I got to be really nice to her so she doesn't fucking go to the police.
It was funny, too, when they were talking about not getting along on the trip. She said something about it seemed like she takes too many pictures. But the other thing they cited was she wasn't warming up to him. And I'm like, oh, you guys still weren't having sex. Like, he took you on this trip and you didn't have sex with him. He took you to Japan and you didn't have sex with him. I mean, that's my read on that. But I was like,
go
yeah.
queen.
So he
you know
was
what?
Like,
okay, sure.
Yeah, she snuck this trip to Japan in, this free trip. Wow. But it's pretty risky wow. stuff because they come back and they're broken up and she knows the truth about him.
Yeah.
So obviously she doesn't hold the truth for long. She is it weighs on her conscience and she calls it in and she calls this detective and says, I think the guy you're looking for, I had been dating, and he goes by this other name, Michael Lee Smith. And so they end up at his door, are you Michael Smith? And they arrest him. He talks about how his parents never moved and never changed their number, in the sense of maybe he'll find us one day. And that was like such a reminder of, you're ready, bring on the story about how your parents abused you or something, because you ran away and you never went back and you never wrote them and you never told them you were okay. And you called Tom, but you didn't call them. And but it's seemingly he had like totally normal, nice parents. So you just really wonder about him and his mental state. He now, because they have him under arrest and he's years and years, years later, he's lived a whole life. But they're like, what happened? And he's like, well, I left this scene and I went to New York City. I had a little bit of money that we had put in the getaway bag. And then I hitchhiked to Texas and the guy I hitchhiked with stole my money. So I had no money. And I found a guy in Texas who offered to give me a place to crash. And not only that, but he offered to get me a new identity. I'm like, who the fuck is this guy?
But oh, jackpot. You found this
he's
guy?
He's like, you know what you got to do? You got to find somebody that died as a baby that has a similar birthday as you, so you'd be the right age, but they're so young there's not a ton of paperwork on them out in the world. So he goes to the graveyard, he finds a dead baby grave and the name of the baby, as luck would have it, Michael Lee Smith, where you're like, also
how many Michael Lee Smiths are there?
Exactly. Yeah. So then he says that, you know, this is the 80s, it's a very different thing then than it is now. They don't let you do this now. He went to some building and was basically like, I need a birth certificate for me and this is me. And they give him one and it's, you know, certified. And then once Jeez. He has that, he can get a driver's license.
Passport.
He goes and gets a GED. He goes and gets this degree in aerospace engineering. But he says, then I really wanted to be a pilot and do aerospace stuff. He said, but when I'm applying for these jobs, it's the kind of job that they really are going to dig. And if they dug, I didn't know what they're going to find.
Yeah.
So that stalled my career and I had to switch gears. So I went into computers. I became like tech support, web design. I did really well for myself. I got a big house. I got a Viper. I traveled the world. And now he is facing this sentence, but he's saying the nature of you charging me with negligent homicide is I did something negligent that endangered another person and led to their death. But really, this was a we from the get-go. This was always we decided to do this together. Yes, it went wrong, but like, we both knew the risk. We went into it. I didn't hurt her. And the sheriff is like, I have a different take on this. I think the guy's a sociopath. How do you walk away from your parents and your whole life and not nothing? Like, you watch this, your loved one die, nothing. Like, I think this guy is a sociopath. He says that he and Diane had watched Tarzan and Apocalypse Now in the same week, and that's what led to this plan, which is the strangest thing I've ever heard. It's like, God, Netflix, you really need to think about your algorithm, because watching these two movies, they were like, we're going to live off the grid. We're going to go to South America. We just need to be able to fly over the U.S.-Mexico border. But we need to ditch this plane as part of the plan, and we'll get out before it sinks. So they had their bags in their dinghy ready to row. Then they're about to leave on this. They're going to leave to go to the trip. And she's like, I'm pregnant. And he's like, what do you want to do? And she's like, get an abortion. Gets one. And he's like, you still ready to go? And she's like, I'm super ready to go. So they go. He takes off his belt, his seatbelt, he said, because he's like, the wheel is going to keep my body in the seat. The way the wheel goes over my lap, I won't fly out. She keeps hers on. They land. I think they're both surprised about the impact of landing, because when you land in water, it's like hitting cement. It's like hitting concrete. Yeah. The impact is really great. His face is bloody from like hitting the wheel or whatever.
Yeah.
And when he kind of comes to, because he blacks out for a second, he's like, are you okay? And she says, I can't get the seatbelt off. And what they realize is when they landed, they hit the water funny and the plane flipped. So they're upside down. So she's hanging upside down and the belt is keeping her in, and water's rushing in. He says he's halfway out of the plane, halfway in when he lands. But basically he gets disoriented because the plane is upside down. So the door he swims to try to get her out is the wrong door. It's his door and not hers. So when he gets there, he's like, I can't reach. And he's trying to reach through the window and grab her. And the water is gushing in so quickly that it takes down the plane like 20 seconds. So he's reaching for her, he says, and he just sees her upside down calling to him, and it goes under. And it goes under fast. And he can't do anything. So he still ends up pleading guilty to criminal endangerment and criminal mischief. What ends up happening sentence-wise is he's given concurrent 10-year suspended sentences in Montana for the felony criminal endangerment and criminal mischief, and 4.5 months in federal prison for passport fraud. But the time he serves is super short because he's been in jail awaiting trial and they give him credit for time served. He's eligible for immediate release for deportation to Canada. Basically, his total jail time is like 9 months before he's transferred for federal sentencing and deportation. And he lived his whole life. So whatever happened, there is not like necessarily a feeling of a ton of comeuppance or punishment if you do feel like he had a thing in it. And a lot of, I think the mystery of it that remains is we only have his story because he was the only one there, and his story paints a picture of chaos, and like you can very much see it being a realistic story. You could see it being the truth that he and the motive thing, you're like, why?
Yeah.
And it wasn't clear she would die.
Yeah.
But people are saying he saw it sink. It's all of it is a question of what went through his mind. It's sort of a thing of, did he fight to try to save this woman, or did he see her sinking and be like, seems like it'd be easier this way. Like, what kind of man is he?
Yeah.
And it's hard because the phone call that he has with Tom is so blasé. It's so, well, some shit about loving me, some shit about can't live without me, and she's just died. That doesn't like feel right. And watching the interviews, my read on it is he seems not like a sociopath, but like a narcissist. And the idea, I think you'd kind of have to be clinically a narcissist to run away that way so young,
yeah,
when your family's done nothing wrong, and just go fuck them and I'm never going to call them again. And, you know, here we see him alone years later on these dating sites and not really able to connect to people. And he has all these things, but he feels a little off. I mean, it could be autism. Yeah. I don't know. It's just like it just reads as like not connected in the interview, everything.
Yeah.
And even
like, was he like that before that, or was he like that after that? Like, did this break something in him, or was this existing before that incident too?
Mm-hmm. He published a book called A Tear in My Life, The Brutal Truth. And he has a website that he put all the documents from this case up on. So was he a monster? Was he a narcissist? Was he just a young, foolish kid that was in way over his head in a pretty fucking weird situation and did the best he could? And the justice system in many ways sided with him. Like, he didn't have a big punishment for any of this.
Yeah.
And he says he's still in love. But it was funny in the interview. It also hit me weird when he was like, it was like, what do you want people to know? And he's like, well, I lost something very precious to me. And it's not important if people believe me. And I was like, yeah, I'm leaning narcissist. Like, the framework of not talking about the loss of Diane, but like making it still about yourself. It's like you are definitely the lead in the story in your head. And like you lost
something. You have no idea. Yeah, you have no idea.
Forget Diane's parents and what their life has been. And forget like
your parents,
Diane, and who she could have been. And there's no apology in any of it. And there's no ability to imagine being anyone but himself is how it feels when he talks about it.
Oof, oof.
Anyway,
I don't like that.
That's the story.
I don't like that at all. Wow. Yeah. That's an insane story. Thank you, Keith. Thank you, Quinn.
Yeah, mostly Keith. I mean, he does such a good job. I love him.
Well, I think we have to go record a commercial.
Oh.
And I have so much to do, so I do have to run.
Okay.
All right, we're going to stop recording. Hey, Merry New Year, Christmas.
Yeah.
Hanukkah.
Happy Hanukkah
Day. Happy Hanukkah, happy... Hey, you know what? What if we just said happy holidays?
Happy
holidays. People don't say happy holidays enough anymore. People don't say happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Hot take. Okay, happy holidays.
Bye, cheerleaders.
Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.